Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
I cannot swear to you that there is swearing on this show, but there might be. It's the kind of behavior I engage in.
It's Tuesday, June 11th, 2019. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Today, Joe Biden made a horrible statement that caused a lot of consternation. Brace yourself. Gets pretty terrible what he's going to say right here.
You know, a lot of you understand that what loss is, and when loss occurs, you know that, you know, people come up to you and tell you, I understand if you lose a husband, a wife, a son, a daughter, a family member, and lots of times you feel like saying, you know, they say, I know how you feel, and if they hadn't, you look at them, you know they mean well, but you say, you have no idea how I feel. But when it happens to you, you know. That's why I've worked so hard in my career to make sure that, I promise you, if I'm elected president, you're going to see the single most important thing that changes in America is we're going to cure cancer. You think I'm...
Yeah, that's right. That monster wants to cure cancer. Dick. Okay, let's just stipulate that a promise to cure cancer isn't a likely promise that is to be kept. But it is better than the current president's windmill-based misdiagnosis of cancer, and also Donald Trump's ever-burning coal love, which will certainly cause cancer. You know what the real cancer is? Cruelty. And the internet. And prostate, lung, and thyroid. Those are just some of the cancers. So when I heard that Joe Biden announced he wanted to cure cancer, or promise to find a cure, not necessarily that he'd be the guy in the lab coat doing the work, it was presented via the internet as a conscious, well-thought-out policy pronouncement that he had a list of agenda items he could have chosen, and he went with cancer. Yeah, 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 global warming this and income inequality that. Cancer. I'm going with cancer. But to me, I mean, you heard it. It was more amusing, unattached to anything real, perhaps a little doddering and unrealistic, but no cause to scream into the winds or Twitter, you just don't get it, Biden, you don't understand what our country needs. And the wailing and the pulling out of the hair could be a sign you have scalp cancer. Over and over again, I run into this phenomenon where I'm in a position of being a little confused and put off by the deep and abiding Biden loathing, and at the same time, fairly unimpressed with the actual Biden campaigning. Oh, well, if we know one thing, it's this. Joe Biden has just made inroads with the Democrats who hate cancer, while also clearly alienating the Democrats who define cancer as Joe Biden. On the show today, you know, yesterday's spiel went on for a while, so today's will be pithier, and it is on the subject of political pithiness. But first, Michael Brendan Dougherty had a father from Ireland and a mother from New Jersey. He chose not to write a memoir about New Jersey. So, up next, the National Review contributor's new book about religion, identity, and country, My Father Left Me Ireland. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay, the neighbor, and Michelle, We gather around the defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we kvel. To drive the defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. Michael Brendan Dougherty grew up in New Jersey and then in Putnam County, New York, and didn't have a real connection to his father. His father was living in Ireland. And then later, when he became a father himself, he got reconnected to his past through his daughter, through the language of his father, through the experiences he imagined that he might have had. His book, My Father Left Me Ireland, An American Son's Search for Home, is about that, but it's also, and if you know Michael Brendan Dougherty, who writes for National Review. It's also about politics, thinking about nationalism, issues of family and faith, and who we are as a people. Great to meet you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So I love the book, and it was blessedly short, but that means that it was really pointed. Was this one of those books where the original manuscript was a lot longer than the 200 pages you handed in?
Oh, no. This was, in a way, I almost stretched it out. I wanted it to be compact, and partly I think, it's funny, everyone's describing it as memoir, and I thought of it more as of like an argument that I dressed up in memoir, and I don't believe like I'm the interesting thing in it, so I wanted to focus on the experiences, the ideas, the history.
Yes, that's true. You're like the touchstone. You're in all these chapters, but what we're asked to engage with isn't necessarily your processing of those events, either at the time or in retrospect.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like you'll be standing next to your father watching hurling. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so the point isn't your feelings about hurling or your feelings about the father or your father. It's about what this says about the larger argument that you're making.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like I wanted to show, not tell, right?
Yeah.
That scene you just mentioned is at the beginning of the book. And I talk about, being in my early 30s, standing next to my father, and we're standing at a hurling match in Finglas in Dublin.
Best place to watch hurling.
And it's like a local club match. And, when the ball or the slitter, it hits someone's hand in front of the goal, he's like right there in his Dublin accent, bury it. And I'm like a second too late and sound very American standing next to him. And I just thought that image would, from real life, really did show, and it resonated with me of this distance between my father and I, and illustrated this somewhat broken connection between us.
So let's go back to the beginning.
Sure.
What were the circumstances of your birth, son?
So my mother was kind of somewhat of a free-spirited woman and was kind of traveling around Europe, making friends, and she had a best friend, an Irish Londoner. And they went out one night with this Irish Londoner, Teresa. She's my godmother, actually, with her boyfriend and then her boyfriend's friend, who was turned out to eventually become my father. My parents had a like summer romance, basically, on two continents, in Europe and in America. And I was the result. My mother informed my father that I was impending into this world by letter, but he wouldn't see me until I was almost a year old.
Yeah.
So he just returned to his life in Dublin. He went back to an old girlfriend. They formed a family, and he's been a loving husband and father ever since.
How much did you identify as Irish? I mean, your name is Michael Brendan Dougherty, so there's no escaping that. But it waxed and waned your identification with
Absolutely.
Your Irishness throughout your life?
Absolutely. So we grew up at the beginning of my life, in this neighborhood in Bloomfield, New Jersey, Halcyon Park, which was like, it seemed like centuries ago or millennia ago, Irish and Italians had divided this land mm-hmm. among themselves and divided themselves occupationally, that like the Irish were going to be cops and civil servants, as my grandfather was. He was in the IRS, and the Italians would own the local businesses, which were also fronts for criminal activity. And then we would all get together church on Sunday at a church that we kept the Polish people out of somehow. So it just, as a little kid, it's like you're Italian or you're Irish, or you're Jewish or black if you're from outside of our immediate neighborhood. And somewhere down south, there are these Baptists. And that's fitting because it's hot down there. It's closer to hell where they're going to go. So anyway, yeah. And my mother was, you know, in her heartsickness over this love affair with an Irish man. And maybe for my benefit, she took me to Irish cultural festivals, and she kind of, you know, took me to these immersion weekends of speaking Irish only. And she would say goodnight to me in Irish, Ihiwai, or close the door, Dunandoras. And, you know, so that was part of the background. And that was actually an unusual thing for an Irish, a very unusual thing for an Irish American. You know, we would meet with Irish emigres in, emigrants coming over from Ireland. In the 1980s, Ireland was economically depressed, and, you know, the people would be arriving in Queens or in Boston, where, you know, one of my mother's friends was. So there were just Irish people coming in and out of life. It seemed like Ireland was close in some way. We would visit Ireland. Irish music was playing in the house.
Yeah.
So I was given this. Now, it wasn't the only thing I was given. I still had, like, Winnie the Pooh and Sesame Street and eventually MTV and everything else that comes with an American childhood at that time. But that was something that was surrounding me. And also there was a sense of maybe we're going to move there someday to be closer to my father.
Explicitly said, or?
It was implied. Actually, you know, it was funny. When I was 7 or 8, my mother tried to move us to London, actually. She had been very happy there. It would have been closer to my father, and she would have been closer to her best friend. And after my mother died, I found, like, the correspondence she had with the Home Office.
Hmm.
But eventually she decided against it because she didn't want to take me out of my friend groups.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the politics of Ireland and how and if that has affected your political stances. I was always, to me, I'm a Gaelophile. I've always been fascinated by the IRA. And the reason is because I'm drawn to things that upend my either expectations or the general rule of thumb. And if we're told that terrorism usually doesn't work and it's certainly immoral, you could look at what the IRA did as counter to that. Not that there weren't excesses, but fighting for a righteous cause. And it does seem to have worked. I mean, the Good Friday Agreements, without a forceful military part of Irish nationalism, I don't know that those would be in place now.
It's interesting. You know, there are different phases of Irish nationalist struggle. And growing up in the 80s, my mother was wearing a bracelet for political prisoners in Northern Ireland.
Right. This was a big.
This was really engaged in this part of the American Irish diaspora that was itself engaged in the struggle, you know, and literally, like, you know, I talk about being at bars where the caps were passed around for the widows and orphans of West Belfast, and you put money into them, and my mother knew what that money was for.
Which is the guns and ammunition.
Although, honestly, it probably was for Whitey Bulger's coal cabot.
Yeah, there's a little bit of grift involved, too.
Yeah, for sure.
They didn't set off, if you did an accounting, they didn't set off that many bombs when compared to the amount of money that they raised.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So she was engaged in it in that way. My father would have been in Dublin a little bit cooler to the Sinn Féiners and all that. It's, you know, George Orwell has this great passage in an essay on nationalism where he says it's very easy to be nationalist about a country you're not in.
Yeah.
To transfer your nationalism to another country because you're not bearing the costs of it. I'm caught in the middle between my parents on these questions. I understand the reason the Northern Irish Catholics wanted to fight for a united Ireland, even a united socialist Ireland. I also feel I understand why unionists wanted to resist this. But this was part of the background noise. I had this unusually nationalistic upbringing in a way.
Yeah.
Of knowing these songs, this being engaged in politics. And, you know, did terrorism work? I mean, listen, there was a tremendous cost. You're talking about nearly 3,000 people dead in a very small portion of the world over 30 years. The Good Friday Agreement Peter Hitchens, an English writer, the brother of Christopher Hitchens, he considers it a surrender to the IRA.
Yeah.
A slow motion surrender because it you know, the IRA's political prisoners were released. Jerry Adams, Martin McGuinness get to come into a power sharing agreement with Ulster Unionists, and it provides for eventually a referendum, the result of which is if a majority of Northern Irish people vote to join the Irish Republic, and a majority in the Irish Republic votes to accept them, that territory will be ceded to Ireland again.
Do you think that the fact that America is not organized, our tribalism is not organized along sectarian lines, and Ireland's wasn't along ethnic lines, but that's another thing too. Is that progress, or does that damn us more? That we don't even have these, that all we have are, you know, mostly self-appointed ideas, ideological tribes, and it's still just as rigid.
Well, I think the ideological tribes grow out of some of the religious and racial divisions.
They do, but then when you look at the college-educated white people from the South or wherever, so different from the non-college-educated, you do wonder. I mean, it's
you do wonder. No, I think class is a part of certainly a part of it, of which education is a part. And, Jody Bottom wrote a book years ago called An Anxious Age, which beautifully renders how, in a way, the mainstream Protestant, upwardly mobile or wealth-holding part of society, even if they've stopped going to church, their kind of moral impulses are still considered the correct and respectable ones in society, and people assimilate to them.
Right.
And I think I feel like I see that myself, like in this slight realignment of white people in the two major parties where, you know, Pete Buttigieg is like, yes, I'm an Episcopalian and I'm for this kind of moral vision. And you see Catholics and evangelicals who used to be hardcore Democrats, many of them have come into the Republican Party, and they're sort of bringing their populist politics or their statist politics into it. So I think those, even if those lines or tribal lines are attenuated, I think they still matter.
How is it that Ireland is such a we perceive it, they just had a vote to allow abortion, but they're pretty societally conservative, and yet their politics, I suppose their Taoiseach is maybe center-right, Taoiseach is center-right, but, I mean, Mary Robinson and so many of their other political figures are really, and I'm now talking about the Republic of Ireland, are very, very liberal. How is it that they're socially conservative, politically liberal, and what does that offer to the United States?
Irish people, the struggle of Irish independence often was against who they viewed as conservative Tory leaders in the United Kingdom. So there hasn't been a deep conservative tradition that's native to Ireland, mm-hmm. even though Edmund Burke himself was born in Dublin. So that's part of it. The social conservatism, I think, has gone away in many ways in recent decades, as we've seen in the votes for gay marriage or abortion rights. But the demand for social consensus, I think, remains, that Ireland has, at least publicly, this isn't true in private conversation, but publicly there's a tendency in Ireland, and I think this is true for many small nations, for you to settle on a political orthodoxy that is, this is what we think, and we need to hold on to it because this is our method of surviving or getting through to the next age. And right now that political orthodoxy in Ireland is, you know, economically very open to the world, very liberal, very inviting of foreign direct investment, and socially it's a bit more like, let's reformist and liberal. In a way, it's like the 90s. In the 90s have taken root in Ireland, and the 90s are more intensely felt there, whereas everywhere else in Europe and America, that dream, the Clintonite, Blairite dream is dying or dead, but it's alive in Ireland.
My Father Left Me Ireland, An American Son's Search for Home. Michael Brendan Dougherty is that son. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
And now the spiel. Did you miss the president's press gaggle today? I'll catch you up. He said this about Joe Biden.
I think he's the weakest mentally. And I like running against people that are weak mentally. I think Joe is the weakest up here.
Adding, in case we were confused by his stance,
Joe Biden is a dummy.
The president said this about Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi.
Nancy is a mess.
And the president criticized China for playing the tariff game this way.
China will subsidize companies.
While bragging about his policy that in America, he plays the tariff game this way.
We gave $16 billion to the farmers to make up for the deficit with China. We gave them $16 billion. We don't give them it. They earn it because they're patriots.
There are two kinds of patriots who Trump reveres. The suckers who supposedly stand by him while his policies take food off their tables. And these other kind of patriots who are the cornerstone of the concessions that North Korea has already made. The patriots who are coming back in boxes years after the fact.
The remains keep coming back.
No word on the results of DNA tests on those remains. You know, the North Koreans once shipped to the United Kingdom what they said were remains of an airman. No, it was animal bones. Some other things were said by Trump, all of equal substance to what you just heard. You know, when I got into media, there was a concern that news clips were getting shorter. The sage grouses of media criticism and academic departments and grant-funded enterprises would do studies documenting the fact that the average news soundbite was diminishing. In fact, here's a clip from 2011, NPR talking to a reporter named Craig Fairman.
The length of political soundbites shrank from 43 seconds in 1968 all the way down to 9 seconds in 1988.
Cause for concern. And yet, I can't remember the last time I thought that what we just need was more Donald Trump talking. Because if soundbites are unsound in the very important category of truth, then less is more. It is understandable that we were concerned about this once, but we were really fighting a different fight back then. We had mostly effective mechanisms to hold public figures to some semblance of truth. One way for politicians back then to evade and avoid scrutiny was to boil everything down to a short soundbite. It was a symbiotic relationship. The news wanted short soundbites, politicians delivered, and everyone was happy, if not overly informed. Politicians used the abbreviated format to fool the public at times, and it would seem that the networks were happy enough to play it. But it wasn't a rash of untruths. It was just a flaw in the system that had evolved. But now it's quite the opposite. When Donald Trump goes on and on and on for 2 hours speaking to the CPAC conference, no person in their right mind thinks, well, thank God he's not being hemmed in. Now we will be able to get to some real policy detail. In fact, the headline in the Toronto Star of that event by Daniel Dale, the dean of the Trump prevarication beat, was 60 false claims in 2 hours. Trump's CPAC speech was by far his most dishonest single event as president. Of course it was. We went from a time of constraint and limited media culture where depth was at a premium to where we are now, which is exactly the opposite. Now depth, or at least volume, rough synonym, is unlimited. And the struggle is accountability, not the quest for more and more details. And we didn't see it coming. Or more precisely, we were too optimistic about what would be the corrective to the tyranny of the soundbite. Because soundbites actually don't lead to tyrants. Tyrants, or propagandists, are actually prone to go on and on at length in diatribes to the masses. The NPR report that I quoted earlier saw the trends coming down the pike as mostly a positive.
There is one significant development in recent years. Online platforms like YouTube and Twitter allow politicians to reach the public directly.
That development was actually more than significant. It was seismic. And while I have no affection for fitting all the president has to say within a 22-minute newscast or the 3-minute portion thereof that covers the president's pronouncements, that more confined world probably would have been a sufficient defense against Donald Trump. I don't think that forcing pith upon politicians is inherently better than the current atmosphere of prolixity, but I've also come to feel it's not inherently worse. In summation, there is one thing I feel I can do to personally stand against the ravages of loquacity, and it is this. And that's it for today's show that just was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé and Daniel Schrader, who wish a curse upon you, Oliver Cromwell, who raped our motherland. I hope you're rotting down in hell for the horrors that you sent to our misfortunate forefathers, who you robbed of their birthright to hell or Connaught. May you burn in hell tonight. T.J. Raphael, senior producer of Slate Podcast, thinks she's going to hurl. The gist, you know, maybe curing cancer is Joe Biden's overture to Mitch McConnell, the senator from Cigarettes and Coal, who could use a little nudge towards bipartisanship. Oom-pru-de-pru-du-pru, and thanks for listening.